Hi, my name is Gene Bradley. You're listening to KBOO Radio 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. Volunteer-powered, listener-supported, community radio. And with us today in the KBOO studios is Elizabeth Colbert, the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, published by Bloomsbury Publishing. Welcome to KBOO.
Greetings.
It's wonderful to have you here. You've been traveling around on a book tour, so we're happy to have you in Portland.
It's great to be here.
This book that you've written is receiving just a huge amount of attention everywhere. You pick up any newspaper and it's got, like, this is the lead story. It's really had an impact.
Well, I sure hope you're right. I think that there's a tremendous amount of news coming out of the climate science community right now. Mm-hmm. None of it particularly good, to be honest. So I think maybe, you know, it's part of that.
Well, I'm sure I'm among others. I read this in excerpts from the New Yorker originally, and it was great then, but the impact of it between the covers, reading it straight through, is just huge. I mean, you explain the science in a way that non-scientists can sort of like follow along and think they're not getting lost, and it's been called the most concise account of global warming, and I think that's really, really accurate.
Well, thank you.
That's a great job. And in fact, you've won an award already, Magazine Writing Award from the American Association of the Advancement of Science. So.
Yeah, that was very, very nice, because they're a bunch of scientists, so that was a real, it was a real honor.
So you got to write with a scientist, and you got to write with a common reader so far, so you're doing great.
Thank you.
When you started working on this, a couple of years ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah, I was just thinking about how really I set off for Alaska almost exactly 2 years ago. So that was sort of the starting point of what turned out to be a long, long journey.
What did you think you were getting into when you went to Alaska?
Well, I had heard this story, and that's sort of how I was looking for a way to write about climate change. It took me a while to sort of find what we call a vehicle in the journalism business, and the story that I had come across and that I found really compelling was the story that opens the book, and it's about this tiny little town off the Seward Peninsula, on an island off the Seward Peninsula, a native Alaskan village, and that is the very first place that I went to for this book.
One of the really great things about this book is the way you take these particular instances of time and place and weave in these scientific, you know, explanations that just are so powerful. And this is a village that, because of global warming, everything is changing. Everything is coming to an end almost.
Right. It's a village. Archaeological studies have shown that people have lived there at least on a seasonal basis for several hundred years. And it's, as I mentioned, it's on this little island, and what used to happen, or what historically has always happened, is that the sea ice came in the fall, and then when fall storms come in, it's an area that tends to get hit in the fall. The sea ice is like, you know, having a sort of layer of saran wrap over a bowl, let's say, or a tarp over a pool, and it prevented the waves from crashing into this island. And now the sea ice comes in so much later that these fall storms come in and they just eat away at the village, and, you know, houses fall into the water. They've had to move many houses back. And a couple of years ago, they just decided things were so bad that they were going to move the whole village to the mainland and just give up on this island. But I should mention that it's a very expensive proposition, and this is not obviously a wealthy community, and so they're relying on government aid, which has not been forthcoming yet. So they're still there.
Like people in New Orleans. What a deal.
Exactly.
So everything about the way they do business in that village has changed. I mean, they can't go out onto the ice now. They have to go in boats. The ice comes later, gets slushy earlier. So their whole thing about the hunting and everything has to be completely altered from the way they've done business for 100 years.
Right, absolutely. And in fact, I just got an email from them in mid-February, and it said, "Greetings from balmy Shishmaref," and it was 40 degrees, and there was no sea ice. There was open water up to the coast in February. So they've just seen startling changes in all around Alaska and all around the Arctic, and this is sort of one of the themes of the book, that all of these things were predicted. It was predicted that you would first start seeing the effects of global warming in the Arctic, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
In fact, in your book, you say that the most dramatic changes are occurring in the places where the fewest people live, but they're happening so fast.
Yeah, and people, I mean, I think that it's one of the, I don't know if you want to call it ironies, But it's problematic. Very few people are up there, but they're feeling these dramatic changes, and they are, I hope I communicate in the book, you know, harbingers of changes that we're all going to be feeling.
You talk, you go from this Alaska village to a discussion of the whole implication of permafrost melting. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. One of the other trips I took in the book, this is another trip to Alaska I made in August of 2004, and I went through the interior of Alaska with a permafrost scientist from the University of Alaska, and it happened to be a very hot and dry summer. Or I shouldn't say it happened to. That's another, you know, predicted effect of warming, that you'd get that it would get warmer and also drier up in Alaska. And it had been very hot and dry. And there were these forest fires, and they were burning right along the road that we were taking. And in any case, we took this trip through the interior of Alaska, and periodically, he has these monitoring stations, which are these boreholes through the permafrost, and they measure permafrost temperatures. And they've been measuring permafrost temperatures in Alaska for a while, and the permafrost is definitely warming up and thawing. And what happens when permafrost thaws is any organic matter, so plants that grow on this thin layer of soil that's not frozen on top of the permafrost, they die and they get pushed down into the permafrost. And so they're basically frozen and they don't decompose. They don't fully decompose. And so they don't give off the CO2. So plants take up carbon and then these plants basically store it. So they're like a coal deposit. And then when you start heating them up, they start to decompose. And that gives off more CO2 or methane, depending on the conditions. And those are both greenhouse gases, as I'm sure people know. And so it just, the cycle just, you know, it warms up and you put in more CO2 and it warms up more.
And this is the first of the kind of cascading effects that you talk about in the book, that I think you mentioned that in 2005, the CO2 release was like 7 billion metric tons. But the total amount of CO2 locked in this permafrost is like 450 billion metric tons.
Right,
these numbers are staggering.
They are staggering, and that's just an estimate. And you know, scientists have just come out with a paper in England saying that the soils in Great Britain are giving up carbon. So there's a huge, you know, the soils are a huge carbon, a place where carbon basically gets deposited. And if you start to put that carbon back up into the air, then, you know, on top of human emissions of CO2, which, as you say, were some 7 billion metric tons, you're going to get this, you know, this organic release of carbon.
So one thing triggers another. Industrial carbon CO2 release causes natural CO2 release, which becomes greater and greater and greater.
Right.
Unintended consequences.
Absolutely. And these are these feedback loops that climate scientists talk about and that are very, very worrisome. And the climate seems to have a lot of positive feedback loops, which is to say things that take small changes and magnify them, and relatively few negative feedback loops, which take, you know, small changes and make them smaller. So, you know, you do the math. It's quite scary.
The math gets into the big numbers in a hurry.
Yeah, yeah.
You also talk about the Arctic warming and the albedo effect. Did I say that right?
I think they pronounce it albedo.
Okay.
Yeah, that's another feedback. That's exactly right. And what happens is ice is a very, very reflective surface. Sea ice especially is very clean, very white, so it reflects something between 80 and 90% of the sunlight that hits it. But then if that ice starts melting, water is a very absorptive surface. And anyone knows this from their own experience. It's why people wear, you know, light colors in the summer and dark colors in the winter, or drive, you know, dark cars in the north and light cars in the south. So everyone knows this phenomenon. And so you melt some of the sea ice and you get more heat absorption by the oceans, and then you melt more ice and you get more heat. And that is why people looking at the Arctic ice cap say it could be entirely gone. It is definitely shrinking, and shrinking quite rapidly, and could be entirely gone. So we could have no Arctic ice cap, no year-round Arctic ice cap by, you know, the middle of the century.
I think it was last summer there was a picture in the New York Times front page of an ice-free North Pole. That was quite a stunner.
Well, that turned out to be wrong.
Okay, well, I'm not so stunned then.
Yeah. It was a huge embarrassment for the Times, to be honest.
Wow.
The person was on a cruise or something like that, and you know, I don't know if he emailed the Times or what, but said, here I am at the North Pole, but he was actually not at the North Pole.
Oh, okay.
So we do not yet have an ice-free North Pole.
What a relief.
Yeah, there's a few more years.
Now, even as early as like 1850, there was some knowledge that there was a natural greenhouse effect, and in fact, that was a good thing. That was what permits life on Earth.
No, exactly. I mean, it sort of was very interesting to me doing this research to learn some of these things, which I didn't even know, but which are very basic concepts. And there really is absolutely no debate that the greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere naturally, which are not just CO2, but very significantly water vapor, keep the planet at a reasonable temperature. If we had no greenhouse gases in the air, the temperature of the planet, the average global temperature, would be 0 degrees, okay? So frozen, basically. And so there really is no debate over that. There's no debate about the basic concept of greenhouse warming. The only thing that there's any potential debate about is, you know, how bad is it going to be? But all of the evidence that's been amassed, all of the actual evidence as opposed to sort of the phony evidence, suggests it's very, very serious.
So, and this is a real change in thinking, because you mentioned a Swedish scientist, I think in 1894, was talking about industrialization is changing the climate, and because, of course, he was from Sweden, which is a cold place, he thought that might be a good thing.
Right. No, this, as you point out, these concepts have been understood for a very long time, and in the 1890s, a Swedish chemist named Svante Arrhenius, who won the Nobel Prize for a different discovery, figured this out, and he was quite, you know, was very close to what climate models now suggest for what the effects of adding CO2 to the atmosphere would be. But he didn't really foresee several things. First of all, he didn't really think about what the effect of that would be on ecosystems. And so he just thought, well, we'll just sort of warm things up and we'll have a longer growing season and it will be, you know, kind of wonderful. But now people have taken, you know, sort of a more detailed look at the effects on all sorts of living systems, the effects on precipitation patterns, which are really frightening, the possibilities of tremendous droughts, of fiercer storms. So I don't think there are very many people out there who would say a warmer world is simply a better world. But the other thing that Arrhenius didn't understand is at that point they thought that the oceans would take up all the CO2 that we were putting out.
Right.
So he thought it would take 3,000 years for us to double atmospheric CO2s from what are called pre-industrial levels, which is basically before the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. But really, we're on track to double CO2 by the middle of this century.
Yikes. One of the complicated kinds of things that these people didn't understand when they were looking at it back then is the escalator effect and sea ice and salt. Can you talk about it? Because that's fascinating how huge that change would be.
Right. Well, one of the, you know, scenarios that got a lot of, you know, play, I suppose you would say, after the day after tomorrow is this notion that you could change what's called a thermohaline circulation. You could change the ocean circulation patterns, which, among other things, you know, keep Northern Europe from being frozen. Because if you look at the latitude of, say, London, it's really, you know, the same latitude as Hudson Bay. So it's very far north, and it's a temperate climate because of the Gulf Stream. And there's evidence from the climate record that there have been periods where the Gulf Stream, these currents have basically shut down. And one theory is that you add a lot of fresh water to the ocean, and it basically changes the circulation pattern, shuts it down, is how people would refer to it. And that could make Europe a lot colder. Now, as I say, that scenario got a lot of play. It's something that the Europeans are quite worried about. I don't want to dismiss it, but it's, you know, not necessarily the most likely consequence.
Okay. But it's an example of the complicated,
right,
almost a chain reaction that could occur when you start warming things up.
No, absolutely. I mean, the whole, when you think about it, you know, for not very long, you realize that patterns of settlement, patterns of agriculture, all the things that we depend on are very, very climate dependent. And you change them, you know, you change the monsoon season, you change storm tracks. You know, people who rely on rainfall patterns, as we all do, in directly or indirectly, you know, it's very any kind of change in a planet with 6 billion people on it is probably going to produce some very serious problems.
In fact, local example, Portland, Oregon gets its water from snowmelt. And in the local papers, they had estimates that 2080, maybe, there would be no snowpack in the Cascade Mountains if climate models persist.
Exactly. I mean, that's a very, you know, there's going to be severe changes in the water distribution. You know, it may not be in this part of the world a water shortage, but it would certainly change the timing of water. You'd have to have tremendous water collection systems because, as you point out, now you rely on spring runoff. But if you don't, if you're getting all of that in the form of rain, for example, then when the summer comes, you don't have any water. So absolutely, the water implications, there are many people who tell me the implications for water availability are really perhaps the most serious problem that we have to worry about.
Speculation here. If the United States took a leadership role and really pursued the Kyoto protocols, would that be enough to stop things? To turn things around,
right,
to rebalance the ledger?
Well, I mean, I have to be, you know, pretty honest about it and say you can't stop this process. I mean, there are things, the climate is sort of like a battleship, and once you get it moving, it's very, very, you know, it moves on for a while after you've stopped doing anything. So, you know, certain things are sort of already in the pipeline. But if we really made a tremendous effort, one would hope that we could avert some of the worst effects of global warming. I mean, the more CO2 you add to the atmosphere, the warmer the world will get. The warmer the world gets, the more dangerous consequences are likely. So, you know, we really have an obligation, it seems to me, to do everything we can to avoid these disastrous, catastrophic consequences, which may not happen, to be honest, in our own lifetimes, but may well happen in the lifetime of our kids. And I, for one, have little kids, and I feel very, you know, much of a debt to them. I mean, we are leaving them with a tremendous burden, especially if we continue on the path that we're on right now.
You know, there was a bumper sticker maybe 10 years ago that I guess started out as a serious bumper sticker, turned into a joke about we're spending our grandchildren's inheritance in more ways than just money.
Right. No, it's. I mean, some people have sort of compared it to, you know, leaving them with this tremendous national debt. You're just basically running up a huge climatic debt, and that debt will be paid. You know, it will be paid. That's the way the planet works. So someone's going to pay that debt. And as I say, you know, it may be in our own lifetimes. It may not be to our children's lifetimes. But I think that you know, I would appeal to people as parents. And recently, a very eminent climate scientist named James Hansen from NASA said that if we continue on the path we're on, then by the end of this century, we will have committed the Earth to such a degree of warming that it will be practically a different planet. And that is a really frightening thought.
I think you quote somewhere in the book that if things persist, if we don't make changes, it could be hotter than it's been in 10 million years.
Well, right now people say we're already, you know, warmer than we've been in about 2,000 years. But if we continue on the path that we're on, it's likely that we will bring the planet to a point where it has not been in 2 or 3 million years exactly. So we've been in a cycle for the last 2 million years or so of recurring ice ages. And you have to go way back in the geological record before you get to an ice-free world, a world without ice, which is what, you know, we're in the process of setting in motion.
What about local changes? You talk about Burlington, Vermont. What effect can local changes, and maybe you can even talk a little bit about Burlington, Vermont, because it was heartening.
Sure.
A moment of heartening,
right,
stuff.
Right. Well, I went to Burlington, Vermont, which is, you know, by most standards of most cities, a very small city, about 40,000 people, but it's the largest city in Vermont. And they have taken climate change as seriously as any place. There are many cities out here in the Pacific Northwest that are also, you know, Portland being one of them, Seattle, really starting to take this issue very seriously, which is heartening. But Burlington, several years ago, launched something called the 10% Challenge, and it was a challenge to local businesses and local individuals to cut their CO2 emissions by 10%. And they really have put a lot of effort into it, and it has gotten some very, you know, positive results. It's shown that you can do something locally, but it's also shown the limitations of local action.
I mean, I think in your book you say that it really, the China and the United States have such a share of this pie that if they do nothing, then all the Burlingtons in the world aren't going to offset that. That China and the United States have to radically change things.
Right. I mean, we right now, we the U.S., are the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. We emit about a quarter of the world's total. So that's a staggering figure, as you can imagine, since we only have, 4% of the population. But the Chinese are on track to overtake us in about two decades if they continue at their current rate of industrialization. So we are the big emitters. We are the two, really big emitters. And one person, a very committed guy who's really trying to work with the Chinese, said, if you don't get the U.S. and China on board, you can't solve this problem. And if you do get the U.S. and China on board, maybe you can.
Wow. Now, the counterpoint to this is the conservative point, and you talk about it in other articles. It's making the rounds in so-called conservative so-called think tanks, more like the vested interest think tanks. The planet may be warming up, but you can't tell why, so maybe we should stop quibbling about the cause of the climate change and really concentrate on the consequences, which almost reads like marketing opportunities.
It's often cast as a sort of humanitarian thing. So in other words, let's not spend billions of dollars to try to reduce our greenhouse gases. Let's try to address poverty now, in the here and now. And that is a nice argument. And, maybe I suppose if we were going to devote all that money to alleviating poverty, maybe there would even be something to it. But the fact of the matter is that you can't really treat the symptoms of global warming. So in other words, if someone's having, a drought and you just ship them food right now, that is a humanitarian gesture. But the chances are, as you continue to pump greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, more and more people will suffer from drought. So I think in that piece, I compared treating the symptoms of climate change and not treating the causes, treating, diabetes with donuts. It just doesn't work. And it ignores this fact that, I was mentioning earlier, the more greenhouse gases you put into the air, the more changes you set in motion. So you just are creating more and more and more problems.
You say that luck and resourcefulness are essential human qualities, and I think we could all see how that could be. And there are people who look at this as merely an engineering problem. So I guess they read a lot of science fiction, maybe. I don't
right.
know. But what do you think of that?
Well, I hope they're right. People have been trying desperately for, 20 years now to come up with some sort of, Jules Vernian solution to this. And so far, no one has come up with anything remotely plausible, unfortunately. There was this theory that we would seed the oceans and that would, create these plankton blooms or whatever, and this would, take up CO2. But people have pointed out that it would probably have exactly the reverse effect of what was intended. So there's a lot of, real dangers of, it's called geoengineering, and geoengineering solutions were on a massive scale. We are in a geoengineering experiment right now. We're putting a lot of CO2 into the air. And to try to reverse that on a global scale would require massive, massive, geoengineering in the reverse direction. And, Lord knows, I hope someone comes up with that solution, but so far, no one has.
At the end of all this, this is a fantastic book, where do you find your hope?
Well, people keep asking me that. I think that you have to, remain hopeful that people will wake up and take the necessary steps. If you're a parent, you sort of have an obligation to feel that way, and human beings are very resourceful, and we are all, in a sense, essentially optimists because, we all get up in the morning, and many of us have children, and we do believe in the future in some unspoken way, and I do too, and I hope for my kids' sake that we do wake up, but the point of writing this book was to say that, and many scientists said it to me. They use exactly that term, wake up. We are really creating potentially insuperable problems for the next generation, and that is just really irresponsible.
In fact, not just the next generation, but the rest of life on Earth.
Absolutely. And the impact on other organisms, you know, can't be overstated. There already are extinctions linked to global warming. So to add to habitat destruction and all of the other things that we have heaped on, you know, life on Earth, we are now adding climate change. And many people will tell you, many people have worked in conservation their whole lives, will say, you know, all of our efforts will be for nothing if we continue, you know, on this path, because if you have a habitat for, you know, for some endangered species and the climate changes, well, that habitat is useless to that species at that point, and that species will probably try to move.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for coming and talking to us today. This is a really important book. I urge everybody to find a copy of this and read it. And I'm serious. It's been compared to Silent Spring, and I think that's a good comparison. This is just quite a great work, and we want to thank you for coming to Cable and talking to us. We've been talking to Elizabeth Culbert about her new book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. It's published by Contrary. Good luck with your book tour, and once again, thanks for coming and talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Great interview. It looks like a great book. And in fact, we have 2 copies available for interested listeners. We want to give these away as gifts. You can call the receptionist here at KBOO. The number there is 231-8032. But don't call unless you can come down personally down to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th here in Portland during business hours to pick it up. Again, that's 2 copies of the book Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Culbert. We just heard the interview with that Gene Bradley conducted with her. 2 copies of that book are available to give away to you. But you must come down to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue during business hours. The number to call if you want that book, 503-231-8032. Coming up next on KBOO Portland, we have Democracy Now! I'm going to play you one little message before we get to that. So thanks for tuning into the Radio Zine today. To continue listening for Democracy Now!, we're going to hear a defense attorney and a community advocate involved in the case of the 7 men arrested in Miami last week. Also, immigrants' rights activist Nativo Lopez discusses the future of the Senate immigration bill and war, peace, racism, and the World Cup.
Press Watch will be on at a new time Thursday mornings, 30 minutes earlier, at 9 o'clock. I'm Teresa Mitchell, inviting you to tune in at 9 a.m. Thursdays to examine all the stories that corporate media would rather spin or ignore. What's the latest on global warming, imperial wars, corporate-owned government, and the fascistization of the United States? Find out Thursdays at 9 here on KBOO, People-Powered Community Radio.